Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray, and today we're talking about Mercedes Ice and Casper in the Glitter by Philip Ridley. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam.
Yo, 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 yippee, yo, yippee, yo.
Welcome to Ridley Week, which I'm very excited about. This was one on my list right from the beginning of what to do for this podcast.
And I was excited but slightly apprehensive because Ridley is a weird fish.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. both in the children's book game and in his
in your face British theatre genre.
Yeah. yeah, so which is he's more known for and his screenplays. For a period in the 90s, he was definitely pretty well known for his sort of odd children's books.
Yeah, certainly if you look at the cover quotes, it says things like Ridley has to be Dahl's successor and so forth. Mm-hmm. So clearly for a time he was regarded as a big name in kids fiction.
Yeah, no. I in primary school we studied Meteorite Spoon and I think there was just a few years where they were everywhere. And now I think they're actually possibly out of print.
They're quite hard to find. Like, I tend to snap them up when I find them in secondhand bookstores.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, they're not... You don't come across them that often. As for me, I think Kringle Cracks was read to us in primary school, which is the one about the alligator in the sewers. I have vague memories of that one, but I really came to him through, you know, being a theatre student and reading Pitchfork Disney.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think one of the first things we did together when we became friends was read Pitchfork Disney.
Yeah. Yeah, that was good. Nerdy students that we were.
Well, York's the nerdiest of universities, isn't it?
It is.
Like, you know, there aren't many Absolutely. Universities where the Pantomime Society is the biggest society on campus.
Yeah. I remember, like, going to Leeds and just looking at their university and like, oh, this is where the cool people go.
Yeah, totally.
So we're doing Mercedes Ice and Casper in the Glitter, neither of which are straightforwardly horror at all. But, I mean, Ridley's books are hard to categorise in general, and they're sort of kind of fairy tales.
Yeah, urban fairy tales is a term I've seen crop up, which makes sense.
That's what it says, the blurb for Mercedes Ice is an urban fairy story for modern children, which, is a decent enough description of his children's books in general.
And the interesting thing is, right, that there isn't that much difference between the children's books and the plays for adults. I mean, there's obviously far more taboo material. Like general death and destruction in the plays for adults, but in terms of the banter, like the kind of patter, the way the characters talk, and the general poise of the characters, the way people carry themselves, right, and the kind of you know, young whippersnappers in bobby dazzlers with quiffs, themselves and talking in kind of East End patter. Like, that's very common in both.
Yeah, and the fantastical names that they tend to have. They're all these slightly larger than life characters. It is really interesting because they're kind of, the children's books and adult plays are definitely on a spectrum.
Like, they all feel like they belong in the same universe.
Yeah. Just with different ways of different gradations, I guess.
Yeah, different gradations of horribleness.
Yeah. they're definitely, all about cities. And because Ridley lived for nearly all his life in the East End of London. And
he's not dead, is he?
No, he's just moved further out. Yeah, no, don't worry.
Not moved to another plane of existence. Oh, that's good. I'll have to wait for a sec.
He's moved to Deptford or something. But I read an interview and he said he's moved for the first time in his life, just sort of further east.
You of course are. I mean, do you consider yourself an East Ender at heart?
No, I don't think I count at all. Stoke Newington doesn't count.
You sometimes walk with the East End swagger, so.
Yeah, I'm dubious, but.
but you are a London kid.
Yes, yeah. Broadly speaking, not like born and raised, but did live there for a large part of my life, so.
Because I definitely think, I do like Ridley quite a lot, but I suspect that you're, in the way that I can relate to Postman Pat. I imagine that the world of Ridley's books probably makes more intuitive sense to you, in a sense. They're very much city books.
Yes, yes. Particularly the, well, all of them, but the two we're discussing here are fairy tales about cities. Should we get into Mercedes Ice?
Yeah, so Mercedes Ice is the first.
Yeah, and it's one of his earliest, one of his earliest children's books. And basically, the main character, it's like the title being Mercedes Ice, who is a character in the book, the sort of, really the main character is the kind of the tower block, Shadow Point, as the book sort of follows the building from when it starts to be built through to its completation and then its decline and then its destruction at the end of the story. That's my semi-clever point that I came up with while thinking about this. So Rosie Glow, who's later known as Mrs. Ice, is the character whose life is kind of inextricably bound up with Shadow Point. So she's born on the same day construction starts, and she admires it as it's being built and dreams of one day living on its top floor. She marries a boy, Timothy Ice, who also loves the new building, and they get their flat right at the top. But before long, Shadow Point begins to degrade. I've got a quote. It says, "Before long, the smooth grey concrete became buckled and discoloured. The big windows were impossible to clean, so they became thick with dust and let no light in. The silver gleam of the television aerial soon became a rusty forest on the roof of the building, like a gigantic bird's nest. Shadow Point became dark. Hundreds of pigeons and sparrows made their homes in the maze of television aerials. Before long, thousands of birds were squawking and screaming around Shadow Point. The bird droppings stuck to the side of the building and turned green and hard. Soon Shadow Point began to change shape. It started to resemble a mountain, rising bleak and menacing above the rooftops." So Rosie and Timothy also start to become the worse for wear as well. Their relationship's struggling as all Timothy can talk about is cars, and Rosie becomes housebound. Timothy meets his end after being chased up 30 floors of the building by a ferocious rat.
Which I think is the point of the book. I would have bailed out as a kid.
Yeah, no, I actually, I remember specifically reading this book and getting quite freaked out at that point. And my mum sort of looking at it being like, what is this? What are you reading? Like, yeah. And so Rosie's pregnant with her child Mercedes. And this is where the title character comes in. Mercedes Ice, named after the car and that Timothy dreamed about.
Yeah, he's almost like the sort of self-appointed main character.
Yeah, yeah, there's no reason why he is particularly.
But you feel like Mercedes Ice himself would regard himself as the main character.
Yeah, yeah, essentially. He's not not very sympathetic, like a domineering kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Rosie's only friend is Hilda Sparkle, who also has no husband and has a daughter called Hickory. Mercedes and Hickory grow up exploring the flats and sort of knowing every corner of it. Hickory's territory is the basement, and Mercedes is the Ruth, although he wants control over everything, and Hickory as well. And sort of in the end, a series of events lead up to Rosie filling the building with gas and lighting a match and all of Shadow Point collapsing in a huge explosion. The only two survivors are Mercedes and Hickory, and Hickory claims the crown of the Cobweb Kingdom and makes Mercedes her slave.
It's really interesting, the ending, because it's like, you know that everyone else has died. It doesn't explicitly state it, but you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, it's really... It's hard to explain, but sometimes it's like Shadow Point feels like a real building, and then sometimes it feels like this kind of weird magical extension of the people's lives.
Yeah, so the building is kind of... does sort of feel semi-real. It's kind of... no one apart from the named characters ever see anyone else in Shadow Point.
Yeah.
So it has this sort of eerie... it has this kind of eerie urban alienation that comes up a lot in Ridley's stories. I don't know how... have you... I don't know if you've read any... but any others, but...
I think I've got Dakota of the... is it Dakota of the Salt Flats or something like that?
The White Flats.
The White Flats, yeah. I own that one. And say Kringle Cracks, I remember vaguely. But I guess it's true certainly in the plays as well, right?
Yeah.
That in Pitchfork Disney, obviously the brother and sister are up isolated in their flat and they talk as though it's the end of the world. You never quite know if it is actually post-apocalyptic or if it's just that they never leave.
Yeah. There's lots of people living in crumbling buildings or in houses that are standing alone when all the rest around them has been demolished. Or like new houses that have just been built, but hardly anyone's moved into them yet. So there's lots of these sort of weird, sort of empty urban spaces. Yeah. And I was sort of trying to work out sort of why just the tone of this book is very odd.
Yeah.
Like it's very detached, and I think that's because it's following the building, the lifespan of the building, rather than any particular character so much.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, and that the characters, it feels like the lives have been overshadowed by the building, or almost predestined by the building.
Yeah.
That they don't seem to have autonomous lives outside of the building, almost.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's the scope of the story is these flats, the school playground, and a couple of other houses nearby, but that's the extent of the world.
Yeah. Which is how the world often feels when you're a kid, because, yeah. You know, your movements and life are so circumscribed as a child that I think, that's, you know, certainly, like, growing up in a village, you know, it's very different to an urban experience, but, you know, for me, the village was my world, and going even into town, you know, Ipswich town is not a big town, but it felt like a completely other world to me.
Mm.
Like, you know, mostly I was at school or at my house.
Yeah. It has, as we've alluded to, it has a quite extravagant death tally. For a children's book.
And quite a matter-of-fact way of dealing with death.
Yes. So the first death we get is...
Did you actually keep a tally?
I did actually keep a tally, yes. So
I know you well enough that when you said death, tally, I don't know. Rent kept a tally.
Yeah. Skip, the construction worker that Rosie befriends as a little girl when he's building one of the builders on Shadow Point, and she talks to him about how much she loves the building, and one day she sees a stretcher going past with his golden helmet on top, and that's the end of Skip. Both Rosie and Timothy's fathers, they don't just die off screen, so to speak. They meet in the graveyard and say, "Oh yes, my father's dead. My father's dead too."
Yeah.
And then both their mothers die by the time they're living in Shadow Point together.
One of them's knocked down by a bus.
Yes, and the other one chokes on a whelk or a cockle. because Timothy works on the seafood stall in the market. And then, as we've mentioned, Timothy himself is dispatched in quite a horrifying way. And then at the end, Rosie and everyone in the building, apart from Hickory, and if there is indeed anyone else in the building,
yeah.
apart from Hickory and Miss Aneys.
But I think also, like, there's this odd blunted emotional effect amongst some of Ridley's characters. So
yeah.
The kids don't seem particularly concerned that their parents have just been killed at the end of the book.
No.
Like, they just sort of get on with it and like, yeah, I'm the queen of the building now and you're my slave. Like, there's something quite mercenary about a lot of Ridley characters. Like, they're all quite, you know, they're kind of scrappy survivors, and often they're quite hard-edged. Like, I think they'll sometimes be like saying, when you go on to Casper in the Glitter, Casper himself is a sensitive soul, and then is sort of thrust into a world with kind of scrappy survivors.
Yeah. And I think as his books go on, there's more... there's more emotion to them. In fact, like, the most recent one I've read, Zips Apollo, is kind of overflowing with emotion, really.
That's interesting. That's interesting, because I think the plays have gotten colder. I think the earliest plays like Pitchfork Disney are very openly emotional, and I found there's one he wrote recently about a couple who are trying to climb up the property ladder and successively murder lots of people to get nicer and nicer houses, and that one's really kind of nasty and cold.
Yeah.
They followed kind of counter emotional trajectories, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Zip's Apollo, I really like it, but it's kind of bordering on sentimental, I think.
Oh, no!
Oh, no! Emotion! Genuine emotion! Yeah. No, but, yeah.
It's really, you're like, yeah, I just want the horribleness.
I know, I really like it. Okay. And it has a trans character as well. Like, explicitly trans character, which...
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, Ridley is obviously gay. And I think there is generally... Maybe not so much Mercedes Ice. Casper and the Glitter, to me, feels like a very queer book.
Okay, now I've been criticised by Alex for... that we keep saying things are queer and not, they're not explaining why they're queer.
I mean, do you agree with me that Casper and the Glitter?
Yeah, I think it has. Well, I think it's sort of similar to the Oz books, that it has this sort of that has this kind of gaggle of outsiders feel, and like found family. Which is, I think, inherently quite a queer concept.
I think also, and I want to sort of express this without it becoming kind of a weird thing, but I feel like there's a lot of kind of play with femme and butch characters in Ridley's Slough in general.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's just a lot of kind of gender performativity, right?
Mm-hmm.
That characters become very concerned with, you know, say their sparkling suit, or their yeah, wonderful quiff, or their bouffant hairstyle, and that,
yes,
this somehow is part of how they interact with the world, right? It becomes very central to their identity in quite a performative way, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Like Nicolas Cage with his snakeskin suit in Wild at Heart, for instance.
Yeah, there's definitely lots of characters whose style is very central to how they face the world.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. So do you want to describe the basic plot of Casper and the Glitter?
Yeah, I maybe went a bit overboard with this description. It's quite long, but we'll see. I kind of wanted to get it all in.
I mean, I could try to soundtrack it with my accordion.
Why do you have an accordion?
Well, I'm just thinking about, I was reading about, like, what makes podcasts successful, right? They need musical, some musical interludes. It obviously is a problem that I can't play accordion, but...
Okay, well, at some point during this description, just once I've got on for quite a while, just do a little accordion interlude?
Yeah, I'll do a trill. An accordion trill. Cool. Yeah.
All right, good. So, Casper is the title character in a much more usual sense than in Mercedes Ice. He's a 10-year-old boy who has never been allowed to leave the perimeters of his house and garden, and who cooks and cleans for his mother, Pumpkin, who spends her days trying to look as sparkling as possible, and dreams at nights of the days before the neighbourhood was demolished and their house was a functioning beauty salon. One day, a boy called Heartthrob appears in Casper's garden trying to steal his roses. Casper invites him in, and he tells Casper about the world outside and how the city's divided into the glitter and the gloom. The glitter being where the found live, who have homes, and the gloom where the lost live, who are homeless. The next morning, Pumpkin's favourite rose-shaped golden brooch is missing, and Casper is convinced that Heartthrob must have stolen it. He heads out in the night, leaving the garden for the first time on a quest to find the bridge that Heartthrob lives under and get the brooch back. Cue accordion. Great. When he arrives in the city, he gets swept up by the entourage of King Streetwise, who calls himself the King of the Gloom, and lives in a palace that's an abandoned church. He's surrounded by his so-called Argonauts, who cleanse the palace of things he doesn't like moths and roses that remind him of his lost love, with the prettiest hair in the gloom, a girl called Hushabye Brightwing. If they don't do their jobs well enough, King Streetwise gives them a black eye. Casper finds out that Heartthrob was one of King Streetwise's Argonauts who ran away with Hushabye, and he's entranced by the king, so he tells him where to find them. The entourage heads out, but the bridge they arrive at isn't the right one, and when the Lost, who live there, refuse to acknowledge Streetwise as their king, he orders the Argonauts to rip apart all the cardboard that they sleep on. Casper realizes after that Streetwise isn't a friend after all and runs off, only to find the bridge where Heartthrob and Hushabye are staying. They tell Casper to... Yes. they tell Casper the true story of Streetwise, including the fact that all the so-called Argonauts are kids that Streetwise has tempted to run away from home. Casper goes home to Pumpkin and upsets her by telling her that she needs to start doing housework and cooking, and that he wants to have friends of his own. Heartthrob and Hushabye come to his house, but King Streetwise follows the trail of rose petals and bursts in, kidnapping Pumpkin. The three of them make a plan to get Pumpkin back by filling a bathtub with moths, papering over the top and covering it with cream to make it resemble an enormous banoffee pie. His favourite food. Streetwise falls for it, and in the confusion and fear of all the moths, starts knocking over all the candles in the palace, setting it alight. Casper and Hushabye rescue Pumpkin, who's become catatonic from distress, and she's been trapped under a bell in the tower, but the stairs have collapsed and they can't escape. But just in time, Pumpkin snaps out of her fugue state and directs the Argonauts to hold out the gold cloak so they can jump onto it like a trampoline. They escape, and Pumpkin gives a speech offering shelter to all the Lost at her home. That night, Casper gets a visit from a bedraggled and smoke-blackened King Streetwise, who tries to persuade him that Pumpkin doesn't need him anymore and that they should run away into the gloom together. But Pumpkin appears and tells him to go away. Casper and Pumpkin are reunited, and they have a new purpose: to save any more kids from being tricked by Streetwise. Yeah, very good. So I hope that's clear enough. There's a fair amount of plot in Casper and the Glitter.
Yeah, it's like a mini Dickensian street odyssey.
Yeah. What did you make of it? Well, were you reading it for the first time?
And for the first half, I wasn't that keen, and then it suddenly clicked with me, and I loved it.
Okay.
I don't know why. At first, there's always something just a little bit queasy about Ridley, to me. Mm. Kind of, I don't know, that's not quite, like, I guess it's the way that, you know, characters have this tendency to repeat the same phrases. Like, mm-hmm. Everyone seems like just slightly automated, almost. Like, you can imagine that all the characters are little clockwork people or something. Like, and at first, I don't know, I just wasn't clicking with it. And then around midway, it just suddenly all fell into place for me. And after that, I really, really enjoyed it. A long time since that happened. Like, normally, you know, either I'm not sure about a book and it stays like that, or I love it from the start. Whereas it took me a while to get into, but once I settled into it, you know, I mean, I think it's just he is a very peculiar writer, and it had been a while, and I think I needed to sort of adjust back to how Ridley writes. And yeah, once I got back into it, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
He definitely has his own tics. Most of the characters have their own way of addressing people. So the Argonauts, one of them calls everyone chief, one of them calls everyone mate, one of them
everyone
old bean, squire, and then they all sort of say the same thing one after the other, adding their own catchphrase.
Yeah, yeah. You say there's quite a lot of that in Vinegar Street as well.
Vinegar Street is similar, I think. Yeah, the people, I think each character has their own sort of pet name or sort of endearment that they use. That's another really good one. I love Vinegar Street, but it didn't quite sneak into this one. Certainly in Zips Apollo, which is actually entirely dialogue. Interestingly, it's very interesting book. So this way of writing is particularly accentuated in that, where each character has their own font, I think, as well, but also all their vocal tics might help you distinguish them.
I think I really liked Casper as a protagonist as well. Perhaps because I can kind of relate to him a fair amount.
I can imagine that Casper would take very seriously an oath to God and the Queen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was quite a Casper-like child, basically. Mm. So Casper's very kind of by the book. And, you know, he's a kind-hearted soul, really, but he's also a little bit buttoned up. And so he can let things kind of build up and then suddenly get very flustered and upset and indignant about things. Like, I don't know, he sort of fluctuates between sort of self-abasement and indignance. And I was like, that's me. They got my number. And also, he makes a great banoffee pie, and banoffee pie is indeed a dessert of gods, so...
It really is. I don't know if I love banoffee pie before reading this book, or if I'm just... If it's just...
If the book was just great propaganda for banoffee pie.
If the book was just great banoffee pie propaganda, but... Yeah.
Have you tried banoffee pie with a dollop of marmalade on the top, then?
I don't think I have.
Because it did make me want to try it.
Yeah. That's Casper's special trick in making banoffee pie.
Which I have to admit must be nicer than marmalade crumble.
It did remind me of marmalade crumble.
Did it?
Yeah.
That was my old housemate, Tai Hung, wanted to... I can't remember what it was. I think I baked her something and she wanted to make me something, and she'd gone to the supermarket and bought marmalade, I think just sort of thinking that it was like a fruit filling. And so made marmalade crumble, and then so pressured me into eating lots of it, although kind of expectantly watched me as I choked down. I mean, you know, I once ate 1,200 grams of Cadbury's caramel chocolate in one sitting, as I'm sure you remember.
I do. It was pretty
moment,
upsetting,
proud,
to be
no,
honest.
A proud not an upsetting moment. I do remember, like, at the time, I was like, oh, you're like, Adam, you've just eaten all of that. And I was like, oh, yes, I have. And you're like, no, seriously. That's you've got the problem. I'm like, yes, I've got a problem. You're like, I'm not joking. Yeah, I did genuinely feel like I might die. It was awful. My body felt like it was shutting down. Like, it was like, nope, you've done it this time. It was quite scary.
Yep.
But yeah, almost as bad was the marmalade crumble, which was the most relentlessly sugary thing I've ever, like, it burned as it went down. But I think marmalade on banoffee pie is probably...
I think that would probably be quite nice.
Yeah, quite tangy. Sounds good.
Mm.
I think Ridley has a thing for quirky foodstuffs, right? Like, or just characters really liking one foodstuff.
in Scribble Boy, there's two characters who sort of can diagnose people what pizza and ice cream, respectively, they most want to eat, which is an idea I always loved.
Yeah, that's great. I don't know if there are jelly deals in any of his books, but jelly deals strike me as a very Philip Ridley thing.
Mm.
You know, these are the quirky, slightly sort of unusual kind of food stuff you get in Britain.
Mm. Slightly grotesque.
Yeah, slightly grotesque, but slightly scrumptious. Well, not you know, I'm vegetarian, not that I'd eat jelly deals, but you know, they do it for some people.
Yeah. So the thing that this Casper and the Glitter particularly made me think of was sort of parents in Ridley books.
Okay.
So there's lots of imperfect parents and parental figures that are not actually bad people, but like Pumpkin, I mean, quite self-absorbed and miserable and kind of wrapped up in their own problems to the extent that they're oblivious to what their children actually need.
Yeah, Pumpkin's not cruel, but she is neglectful. And I think you do feel for her. You know, you kind of like Pumpkin. There's something you can see why she'd be kind of charming. She's sort of lovable, but at the same time, yeah, she's very much an imperfect mother character.
Yeah, she... until she has a sudden... turn around at the end, but where she realises that she's been selfish and putting too much pressure on Casper, but she is likeable, but she's also very and I think that's Ridley's thing, is he makes these characters likeable. I think he's just quite understanding of these imperfect characters, or imperfect parents.
He doesn't believe in monsters.
Yeah.
I think, like, quite strongly, and even in his adult plays where people can do some monstrous things, I think he's fairly radically compassionate and quite willing to push that, I think, into quite disturbing places, that level of compassion, almost, in some of the adult plays.
Yeah. I think he's very conscious of what has happened to these people that's driving them to act in this way, and like how, you know.
Yeah, I like that Hushabye. In the book, who's probably the most outright heroic figure. I like that she never says that anything's cruel. She always says that it's silly.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like that too. Her kind of just sort of... It does seem, like, kind somehow. So she's just sort of... that people are maybe, they're not bad people, they're just foolish and acting in ridiculous ways. But
yeah, I think I quite like the way she divides up behaviours into silly and sensible rather than good and bad.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is one of the things that I most like about Philip Ridley's children's books, is that lots of characters who would be demonized by other writers are presented as flawed but not irredeemable. Particularly the adults who, so you have, like, in Vinegar Street, sort of, you have a character who's, like, an alcoholic, and you have in Zips Apollo, the mum is like grieving and just sort of incredibly depressed and can't really look after her kids at all. You have, yeah, lots of characters who are suffering in various ways, and that means that they're not great parents, but they're not. It's not because they're bad people.
I like that. I think Rosie Ice becoming housebound in Mercedes Ice is actually pulled off very nicely. That it doesn't quite tip into fat phobia. I think for most writers it would, right? But you know, maybe you could say that maybe it forms into commonplace ideas about eating compulsively and such, but I think it's rendered quite sympathetically. Like,
yeah,
she's certainly never made to seem grotesque at all. And I think this is something that really marks out Philip Ridley as different from Roald Dahl. Right? I quite like Roald Dahl, but Roald Dahl's mean, right? There's Roald Dahl books are properly judgmental.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in a way, I think it's quite a superficial comparison. Like, I can see why you draw the comparison, in that you have these larger-than-life characters and kind of dark fairy tales and characters with eccentric tics. But I think with Roald Dahl, there's often a sense that we're... I like some of the warmer Roald Dahls. Like, I like Giraffe, Pelly and Me quite a lot, for instance.
Mm.
But some of them, like The Twids, it's quite a nasty book. It feels kind of sneering.
Yeah.
So do you think Casper and the Glitter is scary, though? Because you obviously wanted to do Ridley, and you said it doesn't quite count as horror.
No. I think probably... I mean... the scariest part of it is the figure of Streetwise, who wants to tempt children away from their families and their homes to become part of his entourage.
Well, he's a bit of a sort of artful dodger type character from Oliver Twist, in as much as he is a kid himself. Right.
Yeah. He is.
But he uses emotionally abusive tactics, right, to try to lure kids. And I mean, I think the book tries to make a distinction between, you know, what's love and what's forcing people to love you.
No, I mean, I don't think Casper and the Glitter is really horror, but it has that edge. It has that kind of unsettling, sort of mirror world thing, like sort of similar to Neverwhere, kind of the world above the streets and the world below the streets.
Yeah, and the idea that there being these homeless kids that, you know, the respectable, the army of the upright, to quote Virginia Woolf, would just walk past and not pay any heed to. I can read the passage that I did find disturbing. It might be the same bit you... I'd be interested to know if it's also one that leapt out at you. Just a couple of pages. They were almost under the bridge now. Casper could see that the homeless were all about his age. Another train thundered by. It made Casper's ears ring. But the sleeping lost did not wake. They must be used to it, thought Casper. Yellow, blue, yellow, blue. Wake up! Boomed the king. His voice reverberated under the bridge. The lost opened their eyes and struggled out of their cardboard boxes. The king's golden cloak reflected first the light of the street lamp, then the light of the moon. yellow, blue, yellow, blue. "Well, hey there, listen to me, you sleepy lost," announced the king. "I am here to find the love of my life. Hushabye, Brightwing." The Argonauts shuffled forward. "Hushabye, squires, with the beautiful hair, old beans. Love of his life, chiefs. Woof, mateys." Casper could see the Argonauts' faces were twitching with excitement, eyes wide, nostrils flared, tongues licking lips. "Far be it for me," began Jingo, whispering in Casper's ear, "to tell someone with a sequin what to do, but you can put me down now if you want to." Casper did so, then looked at the walls under the bridge. There were several posters, but none of a tropical island. "Good heavens," thought Casper, "this is not the arch." "Do you know where my hushabye is?" the king was demanding. The newly awakened lost shook their heads. The king jumped from his chariot and approached them. Casper said, "This isn't the right bridge." The king glared at him. His eyes changed colour with the light. Yellow, blue, yellow, blue. "There's no poster of a tropical island," explained Casper. "So hushabye isn't here." The Argonauts muttered amongst themselves. "Wrong bridge, squires. Wrong bridge, old beans. Wrong bridge, chiefs. Woof, mateys." Then, "Gracious me," muttered Jingo. The king collapsed to his knees and clutched at his chest. "Ouch," he whined. "Another night without my hushabye. Another night before I see her pretty hair. Ouch, ouch, ouch." Then he glared at the lost. "Tell me, you sleepy and trembling moonlit dudes, do you know who I am?" The lost were too afraid to speak. "Well, hey there, I'm your king," yelled Streetwise. "And that means you belong to me. That means I'm your best friend." He pointed at the lost. "Say it," he demanded. "Soothe the ouch in my chest. Turn my totally yucky night into a little bit of a yum. Say, King Streetwise is my best friend." Stardust and Moonglow snarled. "Say it." Still the lost said nothing. The king got to his feet and raised his fist in the air. His rings gleamed, yellow, blue, yellow, blue. His eyes were raging. The Argonauts muttered. "They're not going to say it, squires. Nothing, old beans. Not a word, chiefs. Woof, mateys." Then, "Gracious me," said Jingo. "Silence." The dogs snarled louder. The king raised his fist in the air. "Tear their cardboard," he screeched. "Tear it all." And suddenly the tunnel was a cauldron of noise and panic. The Argonauts rushed forward and started ripping the cardboard boxes the lost had been sleeping in. The lost screamed. The dogs howled. The Argonauts laughed. The street lamp flickered. Blue, yellow, blue, yellow. Yeah, that bit freaked me a bit.
It's disturbing, yeah.
There's something, I don't know, that like everything feels quite feverish and bestial.
Yeah.
And slightly out of control.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to talk about the illustrations bit, because the illustration by, is it Chris Riddle?
Yeah.
Is presumably one of the lost who looks like, have you got this illustration?
Yeah, no, I have. Yeah, oh, it's definitely, God,
it's horrible, this picture.
It's, just flicking through, ambient flicking through book sounds.
On mine, it's 117.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah, so it's this kind of incredibly sort of squat, dirty sort of figure wearing layers and layers of clothes and this three-pronged bubble hat, sort of seen from above, and like without eyes and mouth wide open, in a scream, and sort of below this cracked street lamp. It's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, it's a really disturbing picture. I find, so you really like Chris Riddle's illustrations, I take it.
I do, yeah.
So what do you like about Riddle's illustrations?
I love all the cross hatching and the use of black and white. I think he's really good at light and dark and sort of the very defined textures of them.
Yeah, that's true. They all look quite tactile somehow.
Mm.
I find them a little bit squirmy. I don't know. They give me weird feelings in my tummy. They're all very knobbly. Like, all the characters are very knobbly elbows and knobbly knees. Like...
Yeah, I think it's part of his quite defined sort of cross-hatching style. They do appear very... There's lots of knuckles and knees and noses that are quite prominent.
Yeah, everything, little sort of things poking out.
Mm.
And clothes that don't quite fit. Like either mm-hmm. really sagging clothes or really tightly pinched in clothes.
Yeah.
Like, it definitely suits Ridley's world.
Mm,
they're a definite match, but yeah, they make me feel a little bit icky. just literally, like, they, I find them, looking at them makes me feel weird.
Okay, yeah.
I can cope, however. Has he also done some books with, like, animals?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because I think I've seen his illustrations of, like, mice or something.
Mm.
Like, little mouse people. And that didn't bother me in the slightest. So it's definitely something about how he does people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they do sort of seem quite like a collection of body parts and clothes, in a way.
Yeah. But, you know... I mean, I'm not saying you're a collection of body parts and clothes, but I can see why you'd like that.
Yeah.
You know, you do like your puppet movements sometimes. Like when you used to do all your shoveling with an imaginary big spoon.
What?
Do you not remember that? You used to kind of do it to freak me out.
I don't remember this.
I don't know if it was, like, a charming thing or you kind of, I think, did it, like, because it was... Like, I don't know, you'd go, like, I get something like, oh, spoon it all up, and then you do, like, this sort of puppet spooning motion, like, really maniacally. like you had a big spoon.
Wow.
You did, I swear, you did this.
No, I mean, it sounds like something I do, I just don't remember.
Oh, it's singed in my memory.
Well, speaking of which, kind of, shall we do our textures of the week?
Oh, yeah, I better get my accordion.
Yeah.
Texture of the week.
Do you want to go first?
I mean, it's sort of what we were talking, you know, I guess sort of Ridley's and Riddle's textures together. But I suppose the marmalade on the banoffee.
Mm.
Like, just because I spent so much time trying to picture it and whether I wanted to eat it or not, I still can't quite decide.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm definitely going to try it. I'll have to report back maybe next time.
Yeah, no, do let us know. I was going to go with Hickory Sparkle's Cape of Cobwebs.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
Just literally, she finds a sheet of cobwebs and puts it around herself as a cape.
And then Mercedes Ice.
Mercedes Ice has his corresponding cape. He makes his devoted mother sew for him by just to fish for rats. Casting a line down the side of the building, reel them in, kill them and skin them and stitch them into a cape of rat skins for her beloved Mercedes.
see, it's funny, mate. Yeah. Like, I'm sort of all right with that.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that's probably, that's all my notes anyway.
Yeah, I don't think I have much more to say, just that, you know, Ridley does offer you some curious worlds to get lost in, so I would recommend them. Like, there's no one quite like him.
Yeah.
He's a...
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, a curious but very engaging writer. I do like him.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I'll add the ones that I've talked about in this to the show notes, so can my little recommended list of Ridley's children's books.
You can find them, you know. Don't order things from Amazon, but I think Amazon independent retailers is maybe ethically okay. Maybe. I can never decide. I sort of feel like, you know,
that is kind of unfortunately one of the only places to get them, really.
Yeah. Well, you can certainly
want to scour lots of secondhand shops.
Yeah, and they do crop up. You know, some of mine are from the secondhand bookshops, so do look out for them.
Tend to have quite glittery covers.
So. Oh yeah, my cover of Casper and the Glitter has a kind of glittery. But it's really one thing I really like about it, right? Is they've obviously got this glitter page, right? Like shiny, you know, hologram stuff, and then cut out. Then over the top of it, you know, it is the blue cover, and then I guess if they've cut out the shapes for Casper and the Glitter, so you can see. Yeah. But then that means that if the cover gets scratched, so because mine's second hand, on the back it's got lots of nicks and scratches, and then you can see the glitter. Like the
nick, that's cool.
Yeah, the nicks and scratches glitter, which seems so Ridley.
Yeah, yeah, that's perfect. Nice. Do you have a sign off?
Bean? Yeah, well, let's just keep it at that then. keep it spooky, old beans.
Keep it spooky, chiefs. Yeah. See you next time.
Should we do the credits?
Yeah. Our intro music's by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music's by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. I've give all their details in the show notes. And you can find us on Twitter at StillScaredPod or email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.